So how is everybody doing? How's the energy level?
This podcast is was recorded at the Blue Summit Water Conference.
That's great. The information is flowing. It's really hard to ever go to a meeting about water without getting into water metaphors. Have you experienced that too? Yeah. Delighted to be here for the last panel of the day called Watch Out, Organizing to Win. And I want to quickly introduce our panelists to leave as much time as possible to the discussion. On my immediate left is Carlene Pickard, who's the Director of Organizing for the Council of Canadians. Welcome, Carlene. And next to her, Al Hassan Adam, who is the coordinator of the Africa Water Network and the Southern Sector Coordinator of the National Coalition Against Privatization in Ghana. So coming from quite far, not from Ghana, I don't think, currently studying in the UK, but very active in Africa on issues of privatization. It's great to have you as part of this panel. Thanks for being here. And Anil Naidu, who's also with the Council of Canadians and organizer of the Blue Planet Project, which is a global campaign challenging privatization around the world. And finally, Shelley Gordon, who is researcher, campaigner extraordinaire with the Canadian Union of Public Employees based in Toronto. So thank you very much. Warm welcome to all of you. So we're here to talk about successes on the waterfront. And I'd like to start, Carlene, with you, and then also Shelley with you, to talk a little bit about some key struggles here in Canada. Carlene, you were involved closely with the Council of Canadians and the communities, lots of good, solid coalition in Whistler on the issue of the privatization of the sewage treatment plant in there. And I'm wondering if you could just tell us what was at stake and what happened.
Well, it's just a real pleasure to be able to talk about the work that we did in Whistler back from January to June was about the time that I was involved in the campaign in 2006. And I've just been the last couple of days looking over the old notes that we had, the old flyers that we put together, the fun events that we did to mobilize the community around the decision, which was pretty much a done deal, but the decision by what's called the Resort Municipality of Whistler, so the municipality in Whistler, to privatize an upgrade of their wastewater treatment plant. The municipality back in early 2005, so about a year before we got involved, had made a decision that they would spend $24 million to undertake a P3 or a public-private partnership using the design, build, and operate model. So effectively the consortium of companies that would bid on doing the upgrade and then do the work on the upgrade would be a consortium of private companies. They would do all of that work and then ultimately in the end control the working of the wastewater treatment plant and effectively have a private service or a private system to do that. So taking it out of public hands and putting it into private hands. So people up in Whistler, when they really came to understand what was happening and what the municipality was about to do, did what I just think is one of those things. It's just amazing. Picked up the phone and called the Council of Canadians and really called QP in British Columbia as well. And at that time, I was in Vancouver as the regional organizer there and said that they were really concerned that there was going to be privatization of their water service and they needed some help. And both our organizations went up there, spent a bunch of time doing some preliminary understanding work on the ground. And I think I'll talk about what then happened in the next 6 months a little bit more in detail a little bit later. But ultimately, mid-June, it was June 12th, when the RMOW was forced to hold a city council meeting and decide that they would, due to completely to community pressure, no longer undertake the P3 model and the upgrade as well as the ongoing operation of the plant would stay in public hands.
That's great. Congratulations. Shelley, you were involved in the fight back against the privatization of the water and sewage treatment plant in Hamilton. And, you know, we keep going back to the summit 10 years ago. This is a really long story. And I think it had actually started before 10 years, right? It's been a story that started more than a decade ago. Can you tell us what that one was about?
At the first water summit in 1999, the biggest privatization of water operations in North America at the time was the operations of water treatment and wastewater treatment in Hamilton. Had been contracted out in 1995 in a sole source deal under the excuse that it was an economic development initiative for the city of Hamilton. And the company that it was originally contracted to was a local company. That company was bought up by an international company. It went through in 10 years, the contract was for 10 years. In 10 years, they went through, I think, six or eight different owners. And by 2004, it was American Water that was operating the plants in Hamilton. The union had kept an eye on it for the whole 10 years, and in 2004, when it came back to City Council to decide what to do for 2005, the union was there and started arguing with the city again that it should come back into public operation, that the 10-year experiment had been a failure. And I won't tell you all the details of that year, but in September 2004, they decided to bring it back in-house, and it's been public since January 1st, 2005.
And Emil, you've been involved in a lot of campaigns in many countries, but I wonder if you could focus on Latin America, because we've had some really key struggles and also some key victories.
Thanks, Mona. We refer to Latin America as the heart of our movement for good reason. If you look back at what the inspiring stories are, you can begin by looking at Cochabamba and what happened there, the unfortunate death of Victor Hugo Daza, a 17-year-old peacefully demonstrating activist, that really galvanized a movement around this issue of pushing for the right to water. Now, Cochabamba is not a success story insofar as we haven't really been able to get a good, well-running water system up there. We're still hopeful and things are happening. But what it did inspire is around all of the Americas, I would suggest, and around the world, it has inspired movements. And the what happened in Uruguay next, many things happening consecutively, but having 300,000 signatures that our friends in Uruguay pulled together and we supported from afar that got a constitutional change that recognized water as human right but also as a public service and that it had to be delivered publicly has had profound change in that country. It then has moved on to Colombia. 3.5 million signatures have been gathered there and counting, and it is on the referendum as well in Colombia. We've seen now, personally, people that we worked with during these times be elevated to the ministerial level. We have Oscar Rivas in Paraguay as a minister of the environment. We have Silvano da Costa in Brazil. We had Evo Morales there, and now he's the president of Bolivia and works closely with us. The ambassador of Bolivia is a strong friend of us. A UN is a strong friend of ours. We have people there now that, through years of struggle, have achieved a recognition for their work. But also in a position to make policy changes, and who we work with and have worked with in Istanbul, for instance, many in QP and the council and others in this room worked with ministers of the government from many of these countries to pull together this coalition of progressive governments. We have much strength coming out of the work that was done in Latin America. We have formed ourselves into something called Red Vita, which is an acronym for the defense of water, right in defense of water in Spanish. And that's an ongoing, really strong base for many other positive things that are happening in the region. And just happy to be part of it.
That's great. Thank you. And Africa, and particularly Ghana, you've been active on the privatization front in Ghana. Can you, and also the African Water Network, you've been very much involved in. Can you speak to us a little bit about what gave rise to the network and also what happened in Ghana specifically?
Well, in Ghana, we started a campaign in 2001 to fight against the lease contract for Ghana Water Company. By then, Suez, Bywater, about nine multinationals were interested in the privatization of Ghana Water Company. So we were able to push the government and the World Bank to the wall. We held them for 6 years. They could not privatize. And in 2006, they had to revise their work plan, and all the private companies, Bywater, Suez, they all pulled out, citing the activities that we've been doing, the campaign that we've launched against them internationally as one of the reasons, because we had fact-finding missions, international fact-finding missions, media exposures, and stuff like that. But what happened was that after they pulled out, there is a publication called International Water Intelligence. It's a kind of private sector newspaper journal type of thing, which makes survey international to look at the concessions that are up for grabs and advise the private companies where to put their monies. And one of the things they wrote about Ghana was that the campaign against privatization is so high that the political risk in Ghana is too high for any private investment. So that was one of the issues that made the World Bank to change the lease contract into a management contract. And even with the management contract, they had to rework around public companies. So this is the trick now, which maybe in later discussion, not this platform, we'll talk about. Public companies are redesigned to go in and take management contract or service contract from another public contract, public corporation. So you can't technically call them privatization. They point out and say, well, they are public institutions, but they are actually working within the framework of private sector. So this is a big problem that we are fighting against. So after this successful thing, semi-successful thing in Ghana, we decided to work around mobilizing more African countries, because by then there were Cameroon, Tanzania, and others who were on the privatization bill. So in 2007, at the World Social Forum in Nairobi, we had 24 African countries coming together to form the African Water Network. And this water network is instrumental in supporting campaigns in Ghana, South Africa. And shortly after 2007, November 2007, we had our first annual general meeting in South Africa. We went to Soweto and did a campaign there. Shortly after that campaign was a court ruling in favor of the local activists in South Africa against prepaid meters. But that victory was short-lived. The Johannesburg municipality appealed against the court ruling, and the court, you know, the usual thing, ruled in favor of the municipality. So we could say there is a song, one step forward, two step backward. That is the kind of thing, yeah? So you say, okay, we had a victory, but it's been taken off from us. So it's a struggle, and in struggle, you don't have to get demoralized because you won a victory and it was taken from you. It should rather give you the heart and the interest and the zeal to fight again. So this is how we started, and we are all part of the Kyoto movement, the wave that we started. I mean, globally, the key thing I would say for water struggles is in Kyoto, when we turned to shred the Camp Dazou's report that was preparing the grounds to take pension funds to fund water privatization globally. We stopped that in Kyoto in 2003, and it didn't happen. But they are revising their notes, and we have to also revise our strategies. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to, hopefully others will pick up this point around defining privatization and being cautious that privatization can also take the form of the corporatization of public utility companies and running them on a for-profit basis and actually trying to expand and take over water services outside
of a particular geographic area. So in all of these struggles, I've heard messages of mobilization, that the victory, the key victory, is actually being able to reach, network, and build a movement around water. What would you say, so Shelley, some of the key strategies that led to this success? And one thing I hear is never give up. That would be one of the strategies. But what else contributed? And I'd like each of you to pick up and think about that, and maybe, you know, what really made the difference?
Well, certainly for the union, it makes all the difference in the world to be able to build a coalition and pull together a Water Watch committee, because we are always treated as having some nefarious self-interest in all of these struggles against privatization. So in that particular year, 2004 in Hamilton, I think it's Canadian Catholics for Development and Peace is the correct, I've even forgotten the acronym now, but they had water as their theme for the year and heard that we were fighting against to bring the water back into public operations and said, why would we only be concerned with this internationally? Why wouldn't we be concerned with this right on our, in our own homes? And were centrally involved in the campaign with us, and that was critical.
So working with the Water Watch and the coalition and the mobilization, Emil?
Well, I mean, I'm going to risk sounding like Obama here, but it's community and hope, I think, is what the common themes are, even though his stock has fallen. You look at, you know, when I first took this job on, I was going, what are the common themes around fighting back? And it is clear to me that it was places where people still had this sense of community, whether it's Kerala, India, or El Alto, Bolivia. They had organized themselves into either the panchayats or the fahuves, the neighborhood councils, and there was some structure there. They knew their neighbors, they worked together, they met, and they used what they had, both in the social infrastructure, but also in the tools around organizing and even legal aspects that they could fight. And that to me was one of the key things that I found that was an example of where the struggles are strong. And you have that in Latin America writ large. There is a common pan sort of Latin American consciousness that they are one people, that there is not this separation, so there's a sense of solidarity, and that would probably be the third word, that I would add. And then the idea of hope is also to say that we have moved as a movement away from just what we're against and to proposing what we stand for, to getting very deeply involved in issues of governance, you know, the public-public partnerships aspect, and working with communities, and the right to water. These are all things that have developed as a part of this larger... It's not a strategy, because that would denigrate it. It's actually a vision that the people have for the way that they want to live, what the future can look like, should look like, and what we're willing to work towards. So those are the three sort of pieces that I see.
I suspect that in Africa that's very true, too, in the work that you've done, that it's about trying to create a different path, right, to the future, and that vision is important, and that the water struggles are part of a broader struggles as well.
Yeah. I mean, it took me almost 4 years to convince my mom that what I was doing is writing and is not just making political enemies. This is what happened. I work in the southern part of Ghana, and my mom lives in the northern part of Ghana. So after 4 years, one day, they had water shortages. And it coincided with one of our programs. And this was on national TV and local radio stations, and everybody calling her, oh, your son is doing well and all this and this. He's fighting for us and stuff. Then she called me and started to explain that she understands what I'm doing now. So that is just my mom. So it tells you how much you have to work to get people who are not affected to realize the impact of what you're doing. In the recent, Ghana has had some elections in 2008, and they changed government, and the opposition for us was quite interesting. Had to ride on a campaign because there's a management contract by a Dutch South African consortium which is not working. And when we were campaigning for a good 6 years about these management contracts and other privatization issues, the political parties were not concerned. Come 2008, the political parties jumped into the bandwagon. The opposition won the election. And interesting, the day that one of them, the opposition leaders, were to be vetted as a water minister, he came to us to ask us for advice to tell him what to say when he goes to meet the parliamentary committee. So, well, we don't count those 2 months as success because it's a different thing, him coming to you for advice. It's another thing when he gets there. He's now a minister. I don't go to his office, but we have to fight him because they haven't abrogated the management contract, which we are fighting to abrogate. So what keeps us going is recently one of the local polyclinic in a slum area for 10 years has no running water. We were able to get the polyclinic running water because we made it a point. We took 20 parliamentarians there to visit the hospital and see the situation. After 1 year of that parliamentary visit before they got water, and this is the situation. So if you see people appreciate what you're doing, you yourself, it's not about an ego, but it's also for you to know that there are people out there listening and people are picking it. Even if they don't come out on the street to shout that we support you, back in their rooms, they support you. They meet you on the street and say, well done, keep going. And that's what makes us doing this and we're keeping going. That's it.
Thanks. So, Carlene, that must resonate as well with you and the campaigning that you've done, not just in Whistler, but also Site 41 and other locations.
Yeah, definitely. I was wanting to sort of speak to some of that kind of key strategy stuff, what were the key strategies that we used up in Whistler, and I think certainly some of the other examples as well. But I was thinking before, just with the folks in Whistler, to be clear that I was at the time living in Vancouver, and while going up to Whistler kind of once a week, even though it's a beautiful, wonderful place to get to go and visit, people who were there, who were part of the Whistler Water Watch committee that formed in coalition with the CUPE local there. I mean, those people really worked every day for sort of 6 months, day and night, and kind of lived and breathed these numbers and figuring out all of the different parts of legislation that had been foreign to all of us before that. So, I mean, much, props to all the work that they had done. The part about what I think was sort of successful, and I was also thinking, I don't want to sound too Obama-esque, but I mean, there are three key things that we managed to do with the folks that we were working with, and one was that I think we were really flexible and kind of sophisticated with our messaging, and we kind of came into this in this kind of crisis situation. We had to stop this immediately, and we weren't quite clear what the timelines were. And so we started off, and someone who I'm very lucky to call a friend, but Blair Redlin went up from CUPE in Vancouver and made a presentation to council. And I think at that point we were trying to really kind of freak everyone out. Like, we definitely had the information that we wanted to share with people about how P3s were a backdoor to water privatization and wanting to link that to drinking water. We were talking about a wastewater plant upgrade, but wanting to link that to drinking water, and then also kind of wanting to link it to NAFTA and bulk water exports and that kind of potential threat. And the city council at that time, or the municipality, they kind of went for it, but kind of didn't. And people on the ground just really felt like they couldn't quite make that connection. And Kim Manton, who's also in the room and working on sewage and wastewater treatments will know it's not that glamorous to finally realize you actually have to be talking about wastewater treatment and you're talking about poo, and that's just what people want to really know. And so they weren't really being able to make the connection between drinking water and wastewater. So we kind of left that behind sort of as quickly as we could, and we looked more to then we talked about the corporations a little bit, and we said, you know, the corporations that could be bidding on doing this upgrade were also drinking water companies or bottled water companies. So we wanted people to, we were testing to see if people would then take the kind of anti-corporate angle and understand what we were saying about privatization being a corporate takeover. And that sort of worked and I think really helped us lay the ground, but where we really had a lot of traction, and I don't mean to say that we changed, I think that all of these things that we said were, you know, true and the message that we wanted to give to people, but what I think is really important in these kinds of struggles is that where we finally really got traction was talking about the loss of local control and talking about the loss of local jobs. And Whistler is, when we actually got into the process that asking where the municipality had to ask people if they wanted a referendum or not, when you actually looked at Whistler to see how many residents are actually there and, you know, what the definition of a resident is, that number is actually quite small because, of course, it's a resort community, so people have houses that they only live in during the winter or, you know, don't sign up or register as residents, that people really wanted to protect their community. They knew everybody in the community. They knew that somebody would lose their job, or they knew someone would lose their decent and their good and their public job if they were, if it was to go the way of the private corporations. So that I think was really important, just to understand and be sort of flexible, but also really taking the temperature of what was working with the community and what wasn't. And the second thing was, I think we also in this, and folks in Whistler, you know, definitely appreciated this and need a lot of this, was we really had to spend a lot of time understanding the process, and I won't go into details, although I'd love to, about what the alternative approval process is and about, you know, the exact number of votes that we had to get and whatnot. But the municipality did have to ask people if they wanted a referendum to decide if the process should go through the P3 process. And, you know, without the support of QP, it would have been a lot more work for us to figure out exactly all the different municipal charters and legislations and things like that. So that the QP local on the ground, you know, was also able to work with the provincial organization and get a lot of that support out to the community. And then the last thing I was going to say just around our strategies was that it was a really decent and honest campaign. We always took the higher ground. We were pretty open with, we were open about who we were in terms of Whistler Water Watch and different organizations that were participating and supporting that. We went out and did talk to other environmental groups that were local environmental groups in Whistler, and they sort of signed on. So we were always clear about who we were. But in terms of the way that we went about collecting signatures to make the municipality decide if they did or didn't want to go forward with the referendum was just providing more information than the municipality itself was providing. So really clear information. We posted that information everywhere. It was in local businesses. It was in places where local people went. So where we had our greatest success in terms of collecting those signatures was at the local recycling kind of bottle depot. We had all the forms that people could sign up there and a huge area of information. And so that when, you know, the crunch time kind of did come in May and June, when both corporations and not the staff in the municipality, but, you know, political people that had their own interests in which way this would go, when they did come out and attack either Whistler Water Watch, or they did attack kind of us, or they did attack like those citizens spreading misinformation, they looked really bad. They didn't really have a good leg to stand on, and we would respond right away, sort of clarifying whatever it was that they had said that we were saying as misinformation. And it was just I think when you run a campaign where you feel like you have a lot of the information and you're wanting to get that information like out to people earnestly, because we were wanting people to participate in this democratic process, in this alternative approval process, then people willingly would. And anything that sort of tried to close them out of it just resonated really badly with people and made them suspicious. So those, I think, were really exciting parts of the work and kind of helped us move along towards this eventual June deadline that we had to present the signatures.
I'm interested in this argument, you know, the fact that defending jobs is actually an okay strategy. So often we're told, don't talk about jobs. You know, if it's too self-interested, as if local employment is somehow a bad thing. Shelley, what were the arguments in Hamilton that really worked? Were the international trade agreements raised in Hamilton, or am I thinking of another dispute where this issue about under international trade agreements, if you privatize, you'll never get it back in the public domain?
I think because it had already been privatized, that door was already open in Hamilton. But it is, you never know what argument is going to win the day in some ways. And it varies from community to community. And I think that's really an important part of what Carlene was saying. There were two issues that had come up during the course of the 10 years of privatization that we kept track of. That we kept bringing back, I guess. One was there'd been a huge flood and sewer backup into hundreds of homes in the city of Hamilton, and the company wouldn't clean it up. The city had to clean it up and then take the company to court, and we don't know where that ever went. It was there was an out-of-court settlement, and it was never disclosed to us what the city paid to clean up this mess that the company had made. The other was the original contract had some brilliant clause where all repairs under $10,000 were the responsibility of the private operator, and all repairs over $10,000 were the responsibility of the municipality. So, of course, there were no repairs under $10,000 in 10 years. The municipality paid for them all. And when a councillor who was working with us went and said, what have we paid? What did we pay to fix these plants for this private company for 10 years? They said to him, oh, you'll have to file a Freedom of Information request. And he did. And then they said to him, that'll cost you $15,000 to get that information. So we immediately stood outside City Hall and started collecting loonies for the councillor to pay for his Freedom of Information. But we were unable to move city councillors in Hamilton. Like we convinced them to have a public forum. There were 30 presentations, one in favor of private operation. It was by American Water, 29 against private operation, by all the groups in the community, from the Catholics to the environmentalists to the trade unions. We were all there. Didn't change anybody's mind at all. But the day the vote happened, I'll try to tell a short story here. The day the vote happened, in fact, only American Water put in a bid, and the city expected it would cost about $16 million a year for the contract they had put out. And part of what they had done in the new contract was to change the responsibility for spills and to change the responsibility for maintenance, these two issues that the public had their eye on. So American Water put in a bid for $39 million instead of $16 million, and council said, no, you're out of the race. And American Water said, oh, no, we have another bid. We have another bid. It's in our back pocket, and it's only $13 million. And if we hadn't been watching, they would have gone into the back rooms, gone for the $13 million bid, put all the liability back the way it was, and carried on for another 10 years. But because the public was watching, even though council wasn't supportive of our position, they couldn't kind of go in the back room and change the bid. So it came back to public operation. And one of the right-wing councillors, she was so mad at the end of the day when they had to vote to bring it back to public operation. She said, I want a report every year on how this is going. So every year, annually, they get a report on how much money they have saved by having it in public operation. And how much better the quality of the water is in every month, and it's fantastic. They've saved millions and millions of dollars every year.
Internationally and
in other countries, are the arguments always the same? The one that keeps coming up in Canada is the transfer of risk argument. You know, if you give it to the private sector, somehow we're going to be transferring risk from the public to the private. And of course, you know, what BS is that, as you've just explained, right? When you end up having to do all the cleanup and so forth. Is that the case too? Do these arguments come up? Have they come up in Latin America? Have they come up in Africa?
It's a little tougher to make that argument because often the risk is higher because the companies walk away and they'll sue. For instance, you've seen what happened in Cochabamba. It wasn't going their way, they left. Or in Argentina, when the peso spiked and they were getting paid in pesos, and then or the other way around, they ended up losing the currency shift. They just walked away because they weren't making the money. So I don't think that they use that argument necessarily, except that you're often dealing with capital issues of raising capital.
That's the argument, right? We're going to bring in money.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a false argument, of course, because we all know that private companies cost them a lot more to raise capital. They have to. There's higher risk on the bond markets. Municipalities and countries can raise capital at a lot lower rate, and it's a lot more secure because it's guaranteed by the state than private companies that can. So I think that you've got a lot of holes in the argument. But that doesn't stop it because you're dealing with people, you're dealing with potential corruption that goes on, you're dealing with an overall mindset and paradigm that's being pushed by so many institutions, the OECD, the World Bank, the IMF, our governments, the trade agreements lock people in and push them. Even in the times of an economic crisis, it seems, as Maud was talking earlier, that they're advocating more of the disease to be the cure, right? Go further, spend more, go hand more over, privatize more. And what we're going to see, my fear certainly is that we're going to have shrinking, we're going to have ballooning deficits and debt and shrinking budgets because more is going to be going to pay just servicing that debt. And that's going to be another excuse for our governments to hand over the keys to private sector operators and make us essentially renters in our own homes. And it's only the poaching of the lucrative. They because of the political risk that happened in the South with this uprising against privatization and the good work that's been done, the companies very clearly turned towards the North, and partially because they felt that we would not stand up because it was an insignificant amount of our overall budgets necessarily, or it wasn't on the radar. We're living too fat up here. We weren't really organized. We're all individuals. We're separate. And we proved them wrong. I mean, with the stories from Hamilton and Whistler and Site 41, we have shown that Canadians can organize, that we can come together. We will come together around these issues clearly. And for me, the big issue is to use what tools you have in front of you, right? To be adaptive in the moment, to be organized enough and have people from all the different sectors working together, having that cohesive collective consciousness about what we need to do, and then communication amongst ourselves and then work, it is cooperation, as I tell my 8-year-old, right? That's the key to a lot of this, and solidarity.
This podcast was recorded at the Blue Summit Water Conference. The Canadian Union of Public Employees and the Council of Canadians organized the summit to mark the 10th anniversary of Water Watch. The conference took place in Ottawa, November 27th to 29th, 2009.